But December came and went, a monotony of gray, of muted Christmas carols coming from downstairs. I stayed in bed. It wasn't until February that I got a visitor, home from a back east college. "Adam? Adam, you have a guest," my mom said, gently rapping at my door. It was around dinner time, and I was sacked out, the middle of the night to me. In my haze, I thought it was Mia. I bolted upright, but saw from my mother's pained expression that she knew she was delivering disappointing news. "It's Kim," she said with forced joviality. Kim? I hadn't heard from Mia's best friend since August, not since she'd taken off for school in Boston. And all at once, it hit me that her silence was as much a betrayal as Mia's. Kim and I had never been buddies when Mia and I were together, at least not before the accident. But after, we'd been soldered somehow. I hadn't realized that Mia and Kim were a package deal, one with the other. Lose one, lose the other. But then, how else would it be? But now, here was Kim. Had Mia sent her as some sort of an emissary? Kim was smiling awkwardly, hugging herself against the damp night. "Hey," she said, "you're hard to find." "I'm where I've always been," I said, kicking off the covers. Kim, seeing my boxers, turned away until I'd pulled on a pair of jeans. I reached for a pack of cigarettes. I'd started smoking a few weeks before. Everyone at the plant seemed to. It was the only reason to take a break. Kim's eyes widened in surprise, like I'd just pulled out a Glock. I put the cigarettes back down without lighting up.
"I thought you'd be at the House of Rocks, so I went there. I saw Liz and Sarah. They fed me dinner. It was nice to see them."
She stopped and appraised my room. The rumpled, sour blankets, the closed shades.
"Did I wake you?"
"I'm on a weird schedule."
"Yeah, your mom told me."
"Data entry?" She didn't bother to try to mask her surprise. I was in no mood for small talk or condescension. "So what's up, Kim?" She shrugged.
"Nothing. I'm in town for break. We all went to Jersey to see my grandparents for Hanukkah, so this is the first time I've been back, and I wanted to stop and say hi."
Kim looked nervous, but she also looked concerned. It was an expression I recognized well, the one that said I was the patient now. In the distant night, I heard a siren. Reflexively, I scratched my head. "Do you still see her?" I asked.
"What?"
Kim's voice chirped in surprise. I stared at her and slowly repeated the question. "Do you still see Mia?"
"Yes,"
Kim stumbled.
"I mean, not a lot. We're both busy with school, and New York and Boston are 4 hours apart. But yes, of course."
Of course. It was the certainty that did it, that made something murderous rise up in me. I was glad there was nothing heavy within reaching distance. "Does she know you're here?"
"No, I came as your friend."
"As my friend?" Kim blanched from the sarcasm in my voice, but that girl was always tougher than she seemed. She didn't back down or leave.
"Yes,"
she whispered. "Tell me then, friend, did Mia, your friend, your BFF, did she tell you why she dumped me without a word? Did she happen to mention that to you at all, or didn't I come up?"
"Adam, please."
Kim's voice was an entreaty.
"No, please, Kim, please, because I haven't got a clue."
Kim took a deep breath and then straightened her posture. I could practically see the resolve stiffening up her spine, vertebra by vertebra, the lines of loyalty being drawn.
"I didn't come here to talk about Mia. I came here to see you, and I don't think I should discuss Mia with you or vice versa."
She'd adopted the tone of a social worker, an impartial third party, and I wanted to smack her for it. For all of it. Instead, I just exploded.
"Then what the fuck are you doing here? What good are you then? Who are you to me? Without her, who are you? You're nothing. A nobody."
Kim stumbled back, but when she looked up, instead of looking angry, she looked at me full of tenderness. It made me want to throttle her even more.
"Adam,"
she began.
"Get the hell out of here," I growled. "I don't want to see you again."
The thing with Kim was, you didn't have to tell her twice. She left without another word. That night, instead of sleeping, instead of reading,
I paced my room for 4 hours. As I walked back and forth, pushing permanent indentations into the tread of my parents' cheap shag carpeting, I felt something febrile growing inside of me. It felt alive and inevitable, the way a puke with a nasty hangover sometimes is. I felt it itching its way through my body, begging for release, until it finally came tearing out of me with such force that first I punched my wall, and then, when that didn't hurt enough, my window. The shards of glass sliced into my knuckles with a satisfying ache followed by the cold blast of a February night. The shock seemed to wake something slumbering deep within me, because that was the night I picked up my guitar for the first time in a year. And that was the night I started writing songs again. Within 2 weeks, I'd written more than 10 new songs. Within a month, Shooting Star was back together and playing them. Within 2 months, we'd signed with a major label. Within 4 months, we were recording Collateral Damage, comprised of 15 of the songs I'd written from the chasm of my childhood bedroom. Within a year, Collateral Damage was on the Billboard charts, and Shooting Star was on the cover of national magazines. It's occurred to me since that I owe Kim either an apology or a thank you. Maybe both. But by the time I came to this realization, it seemed like things were too far gone to do anything about it. And the truth is, I still don't know what I'd say to her. Chapter 6. I'll be your mess, you be mine. That was the deal that we had signed. I bought a hazmat suit to clean up your waste. Gas masks, gloves, to keep us safe. But now I'm alone in an empty room, staring down immaculate doom. Messy. Collateral Damage, track 2. When I get onto the street, my hands are quaking, and my insides feel like they're staging a coup. I reach for my pills, but the bottle is empty. Fuck. Aldous must have fed me the last one in the cab. Do I have more at the hotel? I've got to get some before tomorrow's flight. I grab for my phone and remember that I left it back at the hotel in some boneheaded attempt to disconnect. People are swarming around and their gazes are lingering a little too long on me. I can't deal with being recognized right now. I can't deal with anything. I don't want this. I don't want any of this. I just want out of my existence. I find myself wishing that a lot lately. Not be dead or kill myself or any of that kind of stupid shit. It's more that I can't help thinking that if I'd never been born in the first place, I wouldn't be facing those 67 nights. I wouldn't be right here, right now, having just endured that conversation with her. It's your own fault for coming tonight, I tell myself. You should have left well enough alone. I light a cigarette and hope that will steady me enough to walk back to the hotel where I'll call Aldous and get everything straightened out, and maybe even sleep a few hours and get this disastrous day behind me once and for all. You should quit. Her voice jars me, but it also somehow calms me. I look up. There's Mia, face flushed, but also oddly smiling. She's breathing hard, like she's been running. Maybe she gets chased by fans, too. I imagine that old couple in the tux and pearls tottering after her. I don't even have time to feel embarrassed, because Mia is here again, standing in front of me, like when we still shared the same space and time and bumping into each other. Though always a happy coincidence, was nothing unusual, not the slightest bit extraordinary. For a second, I think of that line in Casablanca when Bogart says, "Of all the gin joints in the world, she has to walk into mine." But then I remind myself that I walked into her gin joint. Mia covers the final few feet between us slowly, like I'm a cagey cat that needs to be brought in. She eyes the cigarette in my hand. "Since when do you smoke?" she asks. And it's like the years between us are gone, and Mia has forgotten that she no longer has the right to get on my case. Even if, in this instance, it's deserved. Once upon a time, I'd been adamantly straight edge where nicotine was concerned. I know, it's a cliche, I admit. She eyes me, the cigarette. Can I have one? You? When Mia was like 6 or something, she'd read some kid's book about a girl who got her dad to quit smoking, and then she decided to lobby her mom, an on-again, off-again smoker, to quit. It had taken Mia months to prevail upon Kat, but prevail she did. By the time I met them, Kat didn't smoke at all. Mia's dad, Denny, puffed on a pipe, but that seemed mostly for show. You smoke now? I ask her. No, Mia replies. But I just had a really intense experience, and I'm told cigarettes calm your nerves. The intensity of a concert, it sometimes left me pent up and edgy. I feel that way after shows sometimes, I say, nodding. I shake out a cigarette for her. Her hand is still trembling, so I keep missing the tip of the cigarette with my lighter. For a second, I imagine grabbing her wrist to hold her steady, but I don't. I just chase the cigarette until the flame flashes across her eyes and lights the tip. She inhales and exhales, coughs a little. I'm not talking about the concert, Adam, she says before taking another labored drag. I'm talking about you. Little pinpricks firecracker up and down my body. Just calm down, I tell myself. You just make her nervous, showing up all out of the blue like that. Still, I'm flattered that I matter, even if it's just enough to scare her. We smoke in silence for a while, and then I hear something gurgle. Mia shakes her head in dismay and looks down at her stomach. Remember how I used to get before concerts? Back in the day, Mia would get too nervous to eat before shows, so afterwards she was usually ravenous. Back then, we'd go eat Mexican food at our favorite joint or hit a diner out on the highway for French fries with gravy and pie. Mia's dream meal. How long since your last meal? I ask. Mia peers at me again and stubs out her half-smoked cigarette. She shakes her head. Zankel Hall? I haven't eaten for days. My stomach was rumbling all through the performance. I was sure even people in the balcony seats could hear it. Nope, just the cello. That's a relief, I think. We stand there in silence for a second. Her stomach gurgles again. Fries and pie, still the optimal meal? I ask. I picture her in a booth back in our place in Oregon, waving her fork around as she critiqued her own performance. Not pie. Not in New York. The diner pies are such disappointments. The fruit's almost always canned. And Marionberry does not exist here. How is it possible that a fruit simply ceases to exist from one coast to another? How is it possible that a boyfriend ceases to exist from one day to another? Couldn't tell you. But the French fries are good. She gives me a hopeful half-smile. I like French fries, I say. I like French fries? I sound like a slow child in a made-for-TV movie. Her eyes flutter up to meet mine. Are you hungry? She asks. Am I ever? I follow her across 57th Street and then down 9th Avenue. She walks quickly, without even a faint hint of the limp she had when she left. And purposefully, like New Yorkers do, pointing out landmarks here and there, like a professional tour guide. It occurs to me I don't even know if she still lives here, or if tonight was just a tour date. You could just ask her, I tell myself. It's a normal enough question. Yeah, but it's so normal that it's weird that I have to ask. Well, you've got to say something to her. But just as I'm getting up the nerve, Beethoven's Ninth starts chiming from her bag. Mia stops her NYC monologue, reaches in for her cell phone, looks at the screen, and winces. Bad news? She shakes her head and gives a look so pained it has to be practice. No, but I have to take this. She flips open the phone. Hello? I know. Please calm down. I know. Look, can you just hold on 1 second? She turns to me, her voice all smooth and professional now. I know this is unbearably rude, but can you just give me 5 minutes? I get it. She just played a big show. She's got people calling. But even so, and in spite of the mask of apology she's wearing, I feel like a groupie being asked to wait in the back of the bus until the rock star's ready. But like the groupies always do, I acquiesce. The rock star is Mia. What else am I gonna do? Thank you, she says. I let Mia walk a few paces ahead of me to give her some privacy, but I still catch snippets of her end of the conversation. I know it was important to you, to us. I promise I'll make it up to everyone. She doesn't mention me once. In fact, she seems to have forgotten about me back here entirely, which would be okay, except that she's also oblivious to the commotion that my presence is creating along 9th Avenue, which is full of bars and people loitering and smoking in front of them. People who double-take as they recognize me and yank out their cell phones and digital cameras to snap pictures. I vaguely wonder if any of the shots will make it onto Gabber or one of the tabloids. It would be a dream for Vanessa LeGrand, and a nightmare with Bryn. Bryn is jealous enough of me as it is, even though she's never met her. She only knows about her. Even though she knows I haven't seen Mia in years, Bryn still complains. It's hard competing with a ghost. As if Bryn Schrader has to compete with anyone.
Adam! Adam Wilde?
It's a real paparazzo with a telephoto lens about a half block away.
Yo, Adam! Can we get a shot? Just one shot, he calls.
Sometimes that works. Give them 1 minute of your face and they leave. But more often than not, it's like killing one bee and inviting the swarm's wrath.
Yo, Adam, where's Bryn?
I put on my glasses, speed up, though it's too late for that. I stop walking and step out onto 9th Avenue, which is clogged with taxis. Mia just keeps walking down the block, yapping away into her cell phone. The old Mia hated cell phones, hated people who talked on them in public, who dismissed one person's company to take a phone call from someone else. The old Mia would never have uttered the phrase unbearably rude. I wonder if I should let her keep going. The thought of just jumping into a cab and being back at my hotel by the time she figures out I'm not behind her anymore gives me a certain gritty satisfaction. Let her do the wondering for a change. But the cabs are all occupied, and as if the scent of my distress has suddenly reached her, Mia swivels back around to see me, to see the photographer approaching me, brandishing his cameras like machetes. She looks back onto 9th Avenue at the sea of cars. Just go on ahead, I silently tell her. Get your picture taken with me and your life becomes fodder for the mill. Just keep moving. But Mia's striding toward me, grabbing me by the wrist, and even though she's a foot shorter and 60 pounds lighter than me, I suddenly feel safe. Safer in her custody than I do in any bouncer's. She walks right into the crowded avenue, stopping traffic just by holding up her other hand. A path opens for us, like we're the Israelites crossing the Red Sea. As soon as we're on the opposite curb, that opening disappears as the cabs all roar toward a green light, leaving my paparazzo stalker on the other side of the street. It's near impossible to get a cab now, Mia tells me. All the Broadway shows just let out. I've got about 2 minutes on that guy. Even if I get into a cab, he's gonna follow on foot in this traffic. Don't worry, he can't follow where we're going. She jogs through the crowds, down the avenue, simultaneously pushing me ahead of her and shielding me like a defensive linebacker. She turns off onto a dark street full of tenement buildings. About halfway down the block, the cityscape of brick apartments abruptly gives way to a low area full of trees that's surrounded by a tall iron fence with a heavy-duty lock for which Mia magically produces the key. With a clank, the lock pops open. In you go, she tells me, pointing to a hedge and a gazebo behind it. Duck in the gazebo. I'll lock up. I do as she says, and a minute later she's back at my side. It's dark in here. The only light, the soft glow of a nearby street lamp. Mia puts a finger to her lips and motions for me to crouch down.
Where the hell did he go?
I hear someone call from the street.
He went this way,
says a woman, her voice thick with a New York accent.
I swear to you. Well, then where is he? What about that park?
The woman asks. The clatter of the gate echoes through the garden.
It's locked,
he says. In the darkness, I see Mia grin.
Maybe he jumped over? It's like 10 feet high,
the guy replies.
You don't just leap over something like that. Do you think he has superhuman strength?
The woman replies.
You could go inside and check for him. And rip my new Armani pants on the fence?
A man has his limits. And it looks empty in there. He probably caught a cab, which we should do. I got sources texting that Timberlake's at the Breslin. I hear the sound of footsteps retreating and stay quiet for a while longer just to be safe. Mia breaks the silence.
Do you think he has superhuman strength?
She asks in a pitch-perfect imitation. Then she starts to laugh.
I'm not going to rip my new Armani pants, I reply. A man has his limits.
Mia laughs even harder. The tension in my gut eases. I almost smile. After her laughter dies down, she stands up, wipes the dirt from her backside, and sits down on the bench in the gazebo. I do the same.
That must happen to you all the time.
I shrug. It's worse in New York and L.A. and London, but it's everywhere now. Even fans sell their picks to the tabloids.
Everyone's in on the game, huh?
She says. Now this sounds more like the Mia I once knew. Not like a classical cellist with a lofty vocabulary and one of those pan-Euro accents like Madonna's. Everyone wants their cut, I say. You get used to it. You get used to a lot of things, Mia acknowledges. I nod in the darkness. My eyes have adjusted, so I can see that the garden is pretty big, an expanse of grass bisected by brick paths and ringed by flower beds. Every now and then, a tiny light flashes in the air.
Are those fireflies? I ask.
Yes.
In the middle of the city?
Right? It used to amaze me, too. But if there's a patch of green, those little guys will find it and light it up. They only come for a few weeks a year. I always wonder where they go the rest of the time.
I ponder that. Maybe they're still here, but just don't have anything to light up about.
Could be. The insect version of seasonal affective disorder. Though the buggers should try living in Oregon if they really want to know what a depressing winter is like.
How'd you get the key to this place? I ask. Do you have to live around here?
Mia shakes her head, then nods. Yes, you do have to live in the area to get a key, but I don't. The key belongs to Ernesto Castrell, or did belong to. When he was a guest conductor at the Philharmonic, he lived nearby, and the garden key came with his sublet. I was having roommate issues at the time, which is a repeating theme in my life, so I wound up crashing at his place a lot. And after he left, I accidentally took the key.
I don't know why I should feel so sucker-punched. You've been with so many girls since Mia, you've lost count. I reason with myself. It's not like you've been languishing in celibacy. You think she has?
Have you ever seen him conduct?
She asked me.
He always reminded me of you.
Except for tonight, I haven't so much as listened to classical music since you left.
I have no idea who you're talking about.
Castrell? Oh, he's incredible. He came from the slums of Venezuela, and through this program that helps street kids by teaching them to play musical instruments, he wound up becoming a conductor at 16. He was the conductor of the Prague Philharmonic at 24, and now he's the artistic director for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and runs that very same program in Venezuela that gave him his start. He sort of breathes music, same as you.
Who says I breathe music? Who says I even breathe?
Wow, I say, trying to push back against the jealousy I have no right to.
Mia looks up, suddenly embarrassed.
Sorry, I forget sometimes that the entire world isn't up on the minutiae of classical music. He's pretty famous in our world.
Yeah, well, my girlfriend is really famous in the rest of the world, I think. But does she even know about Bryn and me? You'd have to have your head buried beneath a mountain not to have heard about us. Or you'd have to intentionally be avoiding any news of me. Or maybe you just have to be a classical cellist who doesn't read tabloids.
He sounds swell, I say.
Even Mia doesn't miss the sarcasm.
Not famous like you, I mean,
she says, her gushiness petering into awkwardness. I don't answer. For a few seconds, there's no sound, save for the river of traffic on the street. And then Mia's stomach gurgles again, reminding us that we've been waylaid in this garden, that we're actually on our way someplace else.
Chapter 7. In a weird, twisted way, Bryn and I met because of Mia. Well, one degree of separation, I guess. It was really because of the singer-songwriter Brooke Vega. Shooting Star had been slated to open for Brooke's former band, Bikini, the day of Mia's accident. When I hadn't been allowed to visit Mia in the ICU, Brooke had come to the hospital to try to create a diversion. She hadn't been successful. And that had been the last I'd seen of Brooke until the crazy time after Collateral Damage went double platinum. Shooting Star was in L.A. for the MTV Movie Awards. One of our previously recorded but never released songs had been put on the soundtrack for the movie Hello Killer and was nominated for Best Song. We didn't win. It didn't matter. The MTV Awards were just the latest in a string of ceremonies, and it had been a bumper crop in terms of awards. Just a few months earlier, we'd picked up our Grammys for Best New Artist and Song of the Year for Animate. It was weird. You'd think that a platinum record, a pair of Grammys, a couple of VMAs would make your whirl. But the more it all piled on, the more the scene was making my skin crawl. There were the girls, the drugs, the ass-kissing, plus the hype, the constant hype. People I didn't know, and not groupies, but industry people, rushing up to me like they were my longtime friends, kissing me on both cheeks, calling me babe, slipping business cards into my hand, whispering about movie roles or ads for Japanese beer, one-day shoots that would pay $1 million.
I couldn't handle it. Which was why, once we'd finished doing our bit for the movie awards, I ducked out of the Gibson Amphitheater to the smokers area. I was planning my escape when I saw Brooke Vega striding toward me. Behind her was a pretty, vaguely familiar-looking girl with long black hair and green eyes the size of dinner plates. "Adam Wilde, as I live and breathe," Brooke said, embracing me in a dervish hug. Brooke had recently gone solo, and her debut album, Kiss This, had been racking up awards too, so we'd been bumping into each other a lot at the various ceremonies. "Adam, this is Bryn Schrader, but you probably know her as the Fox nominated for the Best Kiss Award. Did you catch her fabulous smooch in The Way Girls Fall?" I shook my head. "Sorry. I lost to a vampire werewolf kiss. Girl-on-girl action doesn't have quite the same impact it used to," Bryn deadpanned. "You were robbed," Brooke interjected. "Both of you. It's a crying shame. But I'll leave you to lick your wounds or just get acquainted. I've got to get back and present. Adam, see you around, I hope. You should come to L.A. more often. You could use some color." She sauntered off, winking at Bryn. We stood there in silence for a second. I offered a cigarette to Bryn. She shook her head, then looked at me with those eyes of hers, so unnervingly green. "That was a setup, in case you were wondering." "Yeah, I was, sort of." She shrugged, not in the least embarrassed. "I told Brooke I thought you were intriguing, so she took matters into her own hands. She and I were alike that way."
"I see.
Does that bother you?"
"Why would it?"
"It would bother a lot of guys out here. Actors tend to be really insecure, or gay."
"I'm not from here."
She smiled at that. Then she looked at my jacket. "You going AWOL or something?"
"You think they'll send the dogs on me?"
"Maybe, but it's L.A., so there'll be teeny tiny chihuahuas all trussed up in designer bags, so how much damage can they do? You want company?"
"Really? You don't have to stay and mourn your Best Kiss loss?" She looked me squarely in the eye, like she got the joke I was making and was in on it too, which I appreciated.
"I prefer to celebrate or commiserate my kissing in private."
The only plan I had was to return to my hotel in the limo we had waiting. So instead, I went with Bryn. She gave her driver the night off and grabbed the keys to her hulking SUV and drove us down the hill from Universal City toward the coast. We cruised along the Pacific Coast Highway to a beach north of the city called Point Doom. We stopped on the way for a bottle of wine and some takeout sushi. By the time we reached the beach, a fog had descended over the inky water.
"June gloom," Bryn said, shivering in her short little green and black off-the-shoulder dress. "Never fails to freeze me."
"Don't you have a sweater or something?" I asked.
It didn't complete the look.
"Here."
I handed her my jacket. She raised her eyebrows in surprise. "A gentleman."
We sat on the beach, sharing the wine straight out of the bottle. She told me about the film she'd recently wrapped and the one she was leaving to start shooting the following month. And she was trying to decide between one of two scripts to produce for the company she was starting. "So you're a fundamentally lazy person?" I asked. She laughed.
"I grew up in this armpit town in Arizona, where all my life my mom told me how pretty I was, how I should be a model, an actress. She never even let me play outside in the sun, in Arizona, because she didn't want me to mess up my skin. It was like all I had going for me was a pretty face."
She turned to stare at me, and I could see the intelligence in her eyes, which were set, admittedly, in a very pretty face.
"But fine, whatever. My face was the ticket out of there. But now Hollywood's the same way. Everyone has me pegged as an ingenue, another pretty face, but I know better. So if I want to prove I have a brain, if I want to play in the sunshine, so to speak, it's up to me to find the project that breaks me out. I feel like I'll be better positioned to do that if I'm a producer, too. It's all about control, really. I want to control everything, I guess."
"Yeah, but some things you can't control, no matter how hard you try." Bryn stared out at the dark horizon, dug her bare toes into the cool sand.
"I know," she said quietly. She turned to me. "I'm really sorry about your girlfriend. Mia, right?"
I coughed on the wine. That wasn't a name I was expecting to hear right now.
"I'm sorry, it's just when I asked Brooke about you, she told me how you two met. She wasn't gossiping or anything, but she was there at the hospital, so she knew. My heart thundered in my chest. I just nodded.
My dad left when I was 7. It was the worst thing that ever happened to me, Bryn continued. So I can't imagine losing someone like that.
I nodded again, swigged at the wine. I'm sorry, I managed to say. She nodded slightly in acknowledgement.
But at least they all died together. I mean, that's gotta be a blessing in a way. I know I wouldn't have wanted to wake up if the rest of my family had died.
The wine came sputtering out of my mouth, through my nose. It took me a few moments to regain my breath and my power of speech. When I did, I told Bryn that Mia wasn't dead. She'd survived the crash, had made a full recovery. Bryn looked genuinely horrified, so much so that I felt sorry for her instead of for myself.
Lord, Adam, I'm so mortified. I just sort of assumed. Brooke said she'd never heard boo about Mia again, and I would have come to the same conclusion. Shooting star kind of disappears, and then collateral damage. I mean, the lyrics are just so full of pain and anger and betrayal at being left behind.
Yep, I said. Then Bryn looked at me, the green of her eyes reflecting in the moonlight, and I could tell that she understood it all, without my having to say a word. Not having to explain, that felt like the biggest relief.
Oh, Adam, that's even worse in a way, isn't it?
When Bryn said that, uttered out loud the thing that to my never-ending shame I sometimes felt, I'd fallen in love with her a little bit, and I'd thought that was enough. That this implicit understanding and those first stirrings would bloom until my feelings for Bryn were as consuming as my love for Mia had once been. I went back to Bryn's house that night, and all that spring I visited her on set up in Vancouver, then in Chicago, then in Budapest. Anything to get out of Oregon, away from the awkwardness that had formed like a thick pane of aquarium glass between me and the rest of the band. When she returned to L.A. that summer, she suggested I move into her Hollywood Hills house.
There's a guest house out back that I never use that we could turn into your studio.
The idea of getting out of Oregon, away from the rest of the band, from all that history, a fresh start, a house full of windows and light, a future with Bryn, it had felt so right at the time. So that's how I became one half of a celebrity couple. Now I get my picture snapped with Bryn as we do stuff as mundane as grab a coffee from Starbucks or take a walk through Runyon Canyon. I should be happy. I should be grateful. But the problem is, I never can get away from feeling that my fame isn't about me. It's about them. Collateral Damage was written with Mia's blood on my hands, and that was the record that launched me. And when I became really famous, it was for being with Bryn, so it had less to do with the music I was making than the girl I was with. And the girl, she's great. Any guy would kill to be with her, would be proud to knock her up. Except even at the start, when we were in that can't get enough of you phase, there was like some invisible wall between us. At first I tried to take it down, but it took so much effort to even make cracks. And then I got tired of trying. Then I justified it. This was just how adult relationships were, how love felt once you had a few battle scars. Maybe that's why I can't let myself enjoy what we have. Why in the middle of the night when I can't sleep, I go outside to listen to the lapping of the pool filter and obsess about the shit about Bryn that drives me crazy. Even as I'm doing it, I'm aware that it's minor league. The way she sleeps with a BlackBerry next to her pillow. The way she works out hours a day and catalogs every little thing she eats. The way she refuses to deviate from a plan or a schedule. And I know that there's plenty of great stuff to balance out the bad. She's generous as an oil baron and loyal as a pit bull. I know I'm not easy to live with. Bryn tells me I'm withdrawn, evasive, cold. She accuses me, depending on her mood, of being jealous of her career, of being with her by accident, of cheating on her. It's not true. I haven't touched a groupie since we've been together. I haven't wanted to. I always tell her that part of the problem is that we're hardly ever in the same place. If I'm not recording or touring, then Bryn's on location or off on one of her endless press junkets. What I don't tell her is that I can't imagine us being together more of the time, because it's not like when we're in the same room everything's so great. Sometimes, after Bryn's had a couple of glasses of wine, she'll claim that Mia's what's between us. "Why don't you just go back to your ghost?" she'll say. "I'm tired of competing with her."
Nobody can compete with you,
I tell her, kissing her on the forehead. And I'm not lying. Nobody can compete with Brynn. And then I tell her it's not Mia. It's not any girl. Brynn and I live in a bubble, a spotlight, a pressure cooker. It would be hard on any couple. But I think we both know I'm lying. And the truth is, there isn't any avoiding Mia's ghost. Brynn and I wouldn't even be together if it weren't for her. In that twisted, incestuous way of fate, Mia's a part of our history, and we're among the shards of her legacy. Chapter 8. The clothes are packed off to Goodwill. I said my goodbyes up on that hill. The house is empty, the furniture sold. Soon your smells will decay to mold. Don't know why I bother calling. Ain't nobody answering. Don't know why I bother singing. Ain't nobody listening. Disconnect. Collateral damage, track 10. Ever hear the one about that dog that spent its life chasing cars and finally caught one and had no idea what to do with it? I'm that dog. Because here I am, alone with Mia Hall, something I've fantasized about now for more than 3 years, and it's like, now what? We're at the diner that was apparently her destination, some random place way over on the west side of town. It has a parking lot, Mia tells me when we arrive. Uh-huh, is all I can think to answer. I'd never seen a Manhattan restaurant with a parking lot before, which is why I first stopped in. Then I noticed that all the cabbies ate here, and cabbies are usually excellent judges of good food. But then I wasn't sure, because there is a parking lot, and free parking is a hotter commodity than good, cheap food. Mia's babbling now, and I'm thinking, are we really talking about parking? When neither of us, as far as I can tell, owns a car here. I'm hit again by how I don't know anything about her anymore, not the smallest detail. The host takes us to a booth, and Mia suddenly grimaces. I shouldn't have brought you here. You probably never eat in places like this anymore. She's right, actually. Not because I prefer darkened, overpriced, exclusive eateries, but because those are the ones I get taken to, and those are the ones I generally get left alone in. But this place is full of old, grizzled New Yorkers and cabbies. No one who'd recognize me. No, this place is good, I say. We sit down in a booth by the window, next to the vaunted parking lot. 2 seconds later, a short, squat, hairy guy is upon us. Maestro, he calls to Mia. Long time no see. Hi, Stavros. Stavros plops down our menus and turns to me. He raises a bushy eyebrow. So, you finally bring your boyfriend for us to meet. Mia goes scarlet, and even though there's something insulting in her being so embarrassed by being tagged as my girlfriend, there's something comforting in seeing her blush. This uncomfortable girl is more like the person I knew. The kind who would never have hushed conversations on cell phones. He's an old friend, Mia says. Old friend? Is that a demotion or a promotion? Old friend, huh? You never come in here with anyone before, pretty talented girl like you. Euphemia, he bellows. Come out here, the maestro has a fellow. Mia's face has practically turned purple. When she looks up, she mouths, the wife. Out of the kitchen trundles the female equivalent of Stavros, a short, square-shaped woman with a face full of makeup, half of which seems to have melted onto her jowly neck. She wipes her hands on her greasy white apron and smiles at Mia, showing off a gold tooth. I knew it, she exclaims. I knew you had a boyfriend you were hiding. Pretty girl like you. Now I see why you don't want to date my Georgie. Mia purses her lips and raises her eyebrow at me. She gives Euphemia a faux guilty smile. Caught me. Now come on, leave them be, Stavros interjects, swatting Euphemia on the hip and edging in front of her. Maestro, you want your usual? Mia nods. And your boyfriend? Mia actually cringes, and the silence at the table lengthens like dead air you still sometimes hear on college radio stations. I'll have a burger, fries, and a beer, I say finally. Marvelous, Stavros says, clapping his hands together like I've just given him the cure for cancer. Cheeseburger deluxe, side of onion rings. Your young man is too skinny, just like you. You'll never have healthy kids if you don't put some meat on your bones, Euphemia adds. Mia cradles her head in her hands, as though she's literally trying to disappear into her own body. After they leave, she peeks up. God, that was just awkward. Clearly they didn't recognize you. But they knew who you were.
Wouldn't have pegged them as classical music buffs. Then I looked down at my jeans, my black t-shirt, my beat-up sneaks. Once upon a time, I'd been a classical music fan too, so there's no telling. Mia laughs. Oh, they're not. Euphemia knows me from playing in the subway.
You bust in the subway? Time's that tough?
And then I realize what I just said and want to hit rewind. You don't ask somebody like Mia if times are tough, even though I knew financially they weren't. Denny had taken out a supplemental life insurance policy in addition to the one he had through the teachers' union, and that had left Mia pretty comfortable. Although no one knew about the second policy right away. It was one of the reasons that, after the accident, a bunch of musicians in town had played a series of benefit concerts and raised close to $5,000 for Mia's Juilliard fund. The outpouring had moved her grandparents, and me too. But it had infuriated Mia. She'd refused to take the donation, calling it blood money. And when her grandfather had suggested that accepting other people's generosity was itself an act of generosity that might help people in the community feel better, she'd scoffed that it wasn't her job to make other people feel better. But Mia just smiles. It was a blast, and surprisingly lucrative. Euphemia saw me, and when I came here to eat, she remembered me from the Columbus Circle station. She proudly informed me that she'd put a whole dollar into my case. Mia's phone rings. We both stop to listen to the tinny melody. Beethoven plays on and on. Are you going to get that? I asked. She shakes her head, looking vaguely guilty. No sooner does the ringing stop than it pipes up again. You're popular tonight. Not so much popular as in trouble. I was supposed to be at this dinner after the concert. Lots of bigwigs, agents, donors. I'm pretty sure that's either a Juilliard professor, someone from Young Concert Artists, or my management calling to yell at me. Or Ernesto, I say, as lightly as humanly possible. Because Stavros and Euphemia may have been onto something about Mia having some fancy-pants boyfriend, one that she doesn't drag into Greek diners. He just isn't me. Mia looks uncomfortable again. Could be. If you have people to talk to, or, you know, business to attend to, don't let me stand in your way. No, I should just turn this off. She reaches into her bag and powers down the phone. Stavros comes by with an iced coffee for Mia and a Budweiser for me, and leaves another awkward pause in his wake. So, I begin. So, Mia repeats. So, you have a usual at this place. This, like, your regular spot? I come for the Spanakopita, and nagging. It's close to campus, so I used to come here a lot.
Used to?
For like the 20th time tonight, I do the math. It's been 3 years since Mia left for Juilliard. That would make her a senior this fall. But she's playing Carnegie Hall? She has management? I'm suddenly wishing I'd paid more attention to that article. Why not anymore? My frustration echoes through the din. Mia's face prickles up to attention, and a little caterpillar of anxiety bunches up above the bridge of her nose. What? She says quickly. Aren't you still in school? Oh, that, she says, relief unfurling her brow. I should have explained it before. I graduated in the spring. Juilliard has a 3-year degree option for...
virtuosos.
I mean it as a compliment, but my annoyance at not having the baseball card on Mia Hall, the stats, highlights, career bests, turns it bitter.
Gifted students, Mia corrects, almost apologetically. I graduated early, so I can start touring sooner. Now, actually. It all starts now.
Oh. We sit there in an awkward silence until Stavros arrives with the food. I didn't think I was hungry when we ordered, but as soon as I smell the burger, my stomach starts rumbling. I realize all I've eaten today is a couple of hot dogs. Stavros lays down a bunch of plates in front of Mia. A salad, a spinach pie, french fries, rice pudding.
That's your regular? I ask.
I told you, I haven't eaten in 2 days. And you know how much I can put away? Or new, I mean.
You need anything, Maestro? You just holler.
Thanks, Stavros.
After he leaves, we both kill a few minutes drowning our fries and the conversation in ketchup.
So, I begin.
So,
she repeats. Then, how's everyone, the rest of the band?
Good.
Where are they tonight?
London.
Or on their way. Mia cocks her head to the side. I thought you said you were going tomorrow.
Yeah, well, I had to tie up some loose ends, logistics and all that, so I'm here an extra day.
Well, that's lucky.
What?
I mean, fortunate, because otherwise we wouldn't have bumped into each other.
I look at her. Is she serious? 10 minutes ago, she looked like she was about to have a coronary at the mere possibility of being my girlfriend. And now she's saying it's lucky I stalked her tonight? Or is this merely the polite small talk portion of the evening?
And how's Liz? Is she still with Sarah?
Oh, it is the small talk interlude.
Oh, yeah, going strong.
They want to get married and have this big debate about whether to do it in a legal state like Iowa or wait for Oregon to legalize. All that trouble to tie the knot. I shake my head in disbelief.
What? You don't want to get married? She asks, a hint of challenge in her voice.
It's actually kind of hard to return her stare, but I force myself. Never, I say.
Oh,
she says, sounding almost relieved. Don't panic, Mia. I wasn't going to propose.
And you? Still in Oregon? She asks.
Nope. I'm in L.A. now.
Another rain refugee flees south.
Yeah, something like that. No need to tell her how the novelty of being able to eat dinner outside in February wore off quickly, and how now the lack of seasons seems fundamentally wrong. I'm like the opposite of those people who need to sit under sun lamps in the gloom of winter. In the middle of L.A.'s sunny non-winter, I need to sit in a dark closet to feel right. I moved my parents down, too. The heat's better for my dad's arthritis.
Yeah, Gramps' arthritis is pretty bad, too. In his hip.
Arthritis? Could this be any more like a Christmas card update? And Billy finished swimming lessons, and Todd knocked up his girlfriend, and Aunt Louise had her bunions removed.
Oh, that sucks, I say. You know how he is. He's all stoic about it. In fact, he and Gran are gearing up to do a lot of traveling to visit me on the road. Got themselves new passports. Gran even found a horticulture student to look after her orchids when she's away.
So how are your Gran's orchids? I ask. Excellent. We've moved on to flowers now.
Still winning prizes, so I guess they must be doing well.
Mia looks down.
I haven't seen her greenhouse in a while. I haven't been back there since I came out here.
I'm both surprised by this and not. It's like I knew it already, even though I thought that once I skipped town, Mia might return. Once again, I've overestimated my importance.
You should look them up sometime, she says. They'd be so happy to hear from you, to hear about how well you're doing.
How well I'm doing? When I look up at her, she's peering at me from under a waterfall of hair, shaking her head in wonder.
Yeah, Adam, how amazing you're doing. I mean, you did it. You're a rock star.
Rock star. The words are so full of smoke and mirrors that it's impossible to find a real person behind them. But I am a rock star. I have the bank account of a rock star and the platinum records of a rock star and the girlfriend of a rock star. But I fucking hate that term. And hearing Mia pin it on me ups the level of my loathing to a new stratosphere.
Do you have any pictures of the rest of the band? She asks. On your phone or something?
Yeah, pictures. I have a ton on my phone, but it's back at the hotel. Total bullshit, but she'll never know. And if it's pictures she wants, I can just get her a copy of Spin at a corner newsstand.
I have some pictures. Mine are actual paper pictures because my phone is so ancient. I think I have some of Gran and Gramps, and oh, a great one of Henry and Willow. They brought their kids to visit me at the Marlboro Festival last summer, she tells me. Beatrix, or Trixie as they call her. Remember their little girl? She's 5 now. And they had another baby, a little boy, Theo, named for Teddy.
At the mention of Teddy's name, my gut seizes up. In the calculus of feelings, you never really know how one person's absence will affect you more than another's. I loved Mia's parents, but I could somehow accept their deaths. They'd gone too soon, but in the right order, parent before child. Though not, I supposed, from the perspective of Mia's grandparents. But somehow I still can't wrap my head around Teddy staying 8 years old forever. Every year I get older, I think about how old Teddy would be too. He'd be almost 12 now, and I see him in the face of every zitty adolescent boy who comes to our shows or begs an autograph. I never told Mia about how much losing Teddy gutted me back when we were together, so there's no way I'm going to tell her now. I've lost my right to discuss such things. I've relinquished, or been relieved of, my seat at the Hall family table.
I took the picture last summer, so it's a little old, but you get the idea of how everyone looks.
Oh, that's okay. But Mia's already rooting through her bag.
Henry still looks the same, like an overgrown kid. Where is my wallet?
She heaves the bag onto the table.
I don't want to see your pictures.
My voice is as sharp as ice cracking, as loud as a parent's reprimand. Mia stops her digging.
Oh, okay.
She looks chastened, slapped down. She zips her bag and slides it back into the booth, and in the process knocks over my bottle of beer. She starts frantically grabbing at napkins from the dispenser to sop up the brew, like there's battery acid leaking over the table.
Damn,
she says.
It's no big deal.
It is. I've made a huge mess, Mia says breathlessly.
You got most of it. Just call your buddy over and he'll get the rest.
She continues to clean maniacally until she's emptied the napkin dispenser and used up every dry paper product in the vicinity. She balls up the soiled napkins, and I think she's about to go at the tabletop with her bare arm, and I'm watching the whole thing, slightly perplexed, until Mia runs out of gas. She stops, hangs her head. Then she looks up at me with those eyes of hers.
I'm sorry.
I know the cool thing to do is say it's okay. It's no big deal. I didn't even get beer on me. But all of a sudden, I'm not sure we're talking about beer. And if we're not talking about beer, if Mia's issuing some stealth apology, what are you sorry about, Mia? Even if I could bring myself to ask that, which I can't, she's jumping out of the booth and running toward the bathroom to clean the beer off herself like she's Lady Macbeth. She's gone for a while, and as I wait, the ambiguity she left in the booth curdles its way into the deepest part of me, because I've imagined a lot of scenarios over the last 3 years, most of them versions of this all being some kind of huge mistake, a giant misunderstanding, and a lot of my fantasies involve the ways in which Mia grovels for my forgiveness, apologizes for returning my love with the cruelty of her silence, for acting as though 2 years of life, those 2 years of our lives, amount to nothing. But I always stop short of the fantasy of her apologizing for leaving, because even though she might not know it, she just did what I told her she could do. Chapter 9. There were signs, probably more of them than I ever caught, even after the fact, but I missed them all. Maybe because I wasn't looking for them. I was too busy checking over my shoulder at the fire I'd just come through to pay much attention to the 1,000-foot cliff looming in front of me. When Mia had decided to go to Juilliard that fall, and when by late that spring it became clear that she'd be able to, I'd said I'd go with her to New York. She'd just given me this look. No way.
That was never on the table before, she said. So why should it be now?
Because before you were a whole person, but now you don't have a spleen. Or parents. Because New York might swallow you alive, I'd thought. I didn't say anything.
It's time for both of us to get back to our lives, she continued.
I'd only been at the university part-time before, but had just stopped going after the accident and now had a term's worth of incompletes. Mia hadn't been back to school either. She'd missed too much of it, and now she worked with a tutor to finish up her senior year classes so she could graduate and go to Juilliard on time. It was more going through the motions. Her teachers would pass her even if she never turned in another assignment.
And what about the band? She asked. I know they're all waiting on you.
Also true. Just before the accident, we recorded a self-titled record on Smiling Simon, a Seattle-based independent label. The album had come out at the beginning of the summer, and even though we hadn't toured to support it, the CD had been selling up a storm, getting tons of play on college radio stations. As a result, Shooting Star now had major labels circling, all interested in signing a band that existed only in theory.
Your poor guitar is practically dying of neglect, she said with a sad smile.
It hadn't been out of its case since our aborted opening act for Bikini. So, I agreed to the long-distance thing. In part because there was no arguing with Mia. In part because I really didn't want to quit Shooting Star. But also, I was kind of cocky about the distance. I mean, before I'd been worried about what the Continental Divide would do to us. But now? What the hell could 2,500 miles do to us now? And besides, Kim had accepted a spot at NYU a few miles downtown from Juilliard. She'd keep an eye on Mia. Except then Kim made a last-minute change and switched to Brandeis in Boston. I was furious about this. After the accident, we frequently had little chats about Mia's progress and passed along pertinent info to her grandparents. We kept our talk secret, knowing Mia would have killed us had she thought we were conspiring. But Kim and I, we were like co-captains of Team Mia.
If I couldn't move to New York with Mia, I felt Kim had a responsibility to stay near her. I stewed about this for a while, until one hot July night, about a month before she and Mia were due to leave. Kim had come over to Mia's grandparents' house to watch DVDs with us. Mia had gone to bed early, so it was just the two of us finishing some pretentious foreign movie. Kim kept trying to talk to me about Mia, how well she was doing, and was jabbering over the film like a noisy parrot. I finally told her to shut up. Her eyes narrowed, and she started gathering her stuff.
I know what you're upset about, and it's not this lame movie, so why don't you just yell at me about it already and get it over with, she said.
Then she'd burst out crying. I'd never seen Kim cry, full on like this, not even at the memorial service, so I'd immediately felt like crap and apologized and sort of awkwardly hugged her. After she'd finished sniveling, she dried her eyes and explained how Mia had made her choose Brandeis.
I mean, it's where I really want to go. After so long in Goy, Oregon, I really wanted to be at a Jewish school. But NYU was fine, and New York is plenty Jewish. But she was fierce on this. She said she didn't want any more babysitting. Those were her exact words. She swore that if I went to NYU, she'd know it was because we'd hatched a plan to keep an eye on her. She said she'd cut ties with me. I told her I didn't believe her, but she had a look in her eye I'd never seen. She was serious, so I did it. Do you know how many strings I had to pull to get my spot back this late in the game? Plus, I lost my tuition deposit at NYU. But, whatever, it made Mia happy, and not a lot does these days.
Kim smiled ruefully.
So, I'm not sure why it's making me feel so miserable. Guilt, I guess. Religious hazard.
Then she'd started crying again. Pretty loud sign. I guess I had my fingers in my ears. But the end, when it finally came, was quiet. Mia went to New York. I moved back to the House of Rock. I went back to school. The world didn't end. For the first couple of weeks, Mia and I sent each other these epic emails. Hers were all about New York, her classes, music, school. Mine were all about our record label meetings. Liz has scheduled a bunch of gigs for us around Thanksgiving, and we had some serious practicing to do before then, given that I hadn't picked up a guitar in months. But at Mike's insistence, we were seeing to business first. We were traveling to Seattle and L.A. and meeting label execs. Some A&R guys from New York were coming out to Oregon to see us. I told Mia about the promises they made, how each of them said they'd hone our sound and launch us to superstardom. All of us in the band tried to keep it in check, but it was hard not to inhale their stardust. Mia and I also had a phone call check-in every night before she went to bed. She was usually pretty wiped, so the conversations were short. A chance to hear one another's voice, to say I love you in real time. One night, about 3 weeks into the semester, I was a little late calling because we were meeting one of the A&R reps for dinner at Le Pigeon in Portland, and everything ran a little late. When my call went to voicemail, I figured she'd already gone to sleep. But the next day, there was no email from her. Sorry I was late. You pissed at me? I texted her. No, she texted right back, and I was relieved. But that night, I called on time, and that call went right to voicemail. And the next day, the email from Mia was a terse two sentences, something about orchestra getting very intense. So I justified it. Things were starting to heat up. She was at Juilliard, after all. Her cello didn't have Wi-Fi. And this was Mia, the girl known to practice 8 hours a day. But then I started calling at different times, waking up early so I could get her before classes, calling during her dinner time, and my calls kept going to voicemail, never getting returned. She didn't return my texts either. I was still getting emails, but not every day. And even though my emails were full of increasingly desperate questions, why aren't you picking up your cell? Did you lose it? Are you okay? Her responses glossed right over everything. She just claimed to be busy. I decided to go visit her grandparents. I'd pretty much lived with them for 5 months while Mia was recovering and had promised to visit frequently, but I'd reneged on that. I found it hard to be in that drafty old house with its photo gallery of ghosts, a wedding portrait of Denny and Kat, a gut-wrenching shot of 12-year-old Mia reading to Teddy on her lap without Mia beside me. But with Mia's contact dwindling, I needed answers. The first time I went that fall, Mia's grandmother talked my ear off about the state of her garden and then went out to her greenhouse, leaving me to sit in the kitchen with her grandfather. He brewed us a strong pot of coffee. We didn't say much, so all you could hear was the crackling of the wood stove.
He just looked at me in that quiet, sad way that made me inexplicably want to kneel at the foot of his chair and put my head in his lap. I went back a couple more times, even after Mia had cut off contact with me completely, and it was always like that. I felt kind of bad pretending that I was there on social calls when really I was hoping for some news, some explanation. No, what I was really hoping for was not to be the odd man out. I wanted them to say, "Mia has stopped calling us. Has she been in touch with you?" But of course, that never happened because that never would happen. The thing was, I didn't need any confirmation from Mia's grandparents. I knew from that second night when my call went to voicemail that it was the end of the line for me. Because hadn't I told her? Hadn't I stood over her body and promised her that I'd do anything if she stayed, even if it meant letting her go? The fact that she'd been in a coma when I'd said this, hadn't woken up for another 3 days, that neither of us had ever mentioned what I'd said, that seemed almost irrelevant. I brought this on myself. The thing I can't wrap my head around is how she did it. I've never dumped a girl with such brutality. Even back when I did the groupie thing, I'd always escort the girl du jour out of my hotel room or limo or whatever, give her a chaste kiss on the cheek and, thanks, that was a lot of fun, or something with a similar note of finality in it. And that was a groupie. Me and I had been together for more than 2 years, and yes, it was a high school romance, but it was still the kind of romance where I thought we were trying to find a way to make it forever. The kind that, had we met 5 years later, and had she not been some cello prodigy, and had I not been in a band on the rise, or had our lives not been ripped apart by all this, I was pretty sure it would have been. I've come to realize there's a world of difference between knowing something happened, even knowing why it happened, and believing it. Because when she cut off contact, yeah, I knew what had happened, but it took me a long, long time to believe it. Some days, I still don't quite believe it. Chapter 10. Barrel of the gun, rounds 1, 2, 3. She says I have to pick. Choose you or choose me. Metal to the temple. The explosion is deafening. Lick the blood that covers me. She's the last one standing. Roulette. Collateral damage, track 11. After we leave the diner, I start to feel nervous. Because we bumped into each other. We did the polite thing and stuck around to catch up. So what's left except our goodbyes? But I'm not ready for that. I'm pretty sure there's not going to be another postscript with Mia. And I'm going to have to live on the fumes of tonight for the rest of my life, so I'd like a little more to show for it than parking lots and arthritis and aborted apologies. Which is why every block we walk that Mia doesn't hail a cab or make excuses and say goodnight feels like a stay of execution. In the sound of my footsteps slapping against the pavement, I can almost hear the word reprieve, reprieve, echo through the city streets. We walk in silence down a much quieter, much scummier stretch of 9th Avenue. Underneath a dank overpass, a bunch of homeless guys camp out. One asks for some spare change. I toss him a 10. A bus goes by, blasting a cloud of diesel exhaust. Mia points across the street. "That's the Port Authority bus terminal," she says. I just nod, not sure if we're going to discuss bus stations with the same amount of detail we did parking lots, or if she's planning on sending me away. "There's a bowling alley inside," she tells me. "In the bus station? Crazy, right?" Mia exclaims, suddenly all animated. I couldn't believe it when I found it either. I was coming home from visiting Kim in Boston late one night and got lost on the way out, and there it was. It reminded me of Easter egg hunts. Do you remember how Teddy and I used to get about those? I remember how Mia used to get. She'd been a sucker for any holiday that had a candy association, especially making it fun for Teddy. One Easter, she'd painstakingly hand-colored hard-boiled eggs and hidden them all over the yard for Teddy's hunt the next morning. But then it poured all night, and all her colorful eggs had turned to mottled gray. Mia had been tearfully disappointed, but Teddy had practically peed himself with excitement. The eggs, he declared, weren't Easter eggs. They were dinosaur eggs. "Yeah, I remember," I say. "Everyone loves New York City for all these different reasons. The culture, the mix of people, the pace, the food. But for me, it's like one epic Easter egg hunt. You're always finding these little surprises around every corner. Like that garden. Like a bowling alley in a giant bus depot. You know..." She stops. "What?" She shakes her head. "You probably have something going tonight. A club, an entourage to meet.
I roll my eyes. I don't do Entourage, Mia. It comes out harder than I intended. I didn't mean it as an insult. I just assumed all rock stars, celebrities, traveled with packs. Stop assuming. I'm still me. Sort of. She looks surprised. Okay. So you don't have anywhere you need to be? I shake my head. It's late. Do you need to get to sleep?
I don't do much of that these days. I can sleep on the plane.
So...
Mia kicks away a piece of trash with her toe, and I realize she's still nervous.
Let's go on an urban Easter egg hunt.
She pauses, searches my face to see if I know what she's talking about. And of course I know exactly what she's talking about.
I'll show you all the secret corners of the city that I love so much.
Why? I ask her. And then as soon as I ask the question, I want to kick myself. You got your reprieve. Now shut up. But part of me does want to know. If I'm unclear why I went to her concert tonight, I'm thoroughly confused as to why she called me to her, why I'm still here.
Because I'd like to show you, she says simply.
I stare at her, waiting for her to elaborate. Her brows knit as she tries to explain, then she seems to give up. She just shrugs. After a minute, she tries again.
Also, I'm not exactly leaving New York, but I sort of am. I go to Japan tomorrow to do 2 concerts there, and then 1 in Korea. And after that, I come back to New York for a week, and then I really start touring. I'll be on the road for maybe 40 weeks a year, so...
Not much time for egg hunting?
Something like that.
So this would be like your farewell tour? Of New York? Of me? A little late for me.
That's one way of looking at it, I suppose, Mia replies.